The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Under Sir Christopher Wren's dome, a celebration got underway at St. Paul's this morning. But they gathered here in this great cathedral to mark the birthday of a great organisation.
73 years ago, the NHS was created, our nation's greatest achievement.
It provided healthcare free at the point of use for everyone across the nation.
From the cradle to the grave, the NHS is here for us throughout the entirety of our lives.
The NHS will last as long as us folk with faith left to fight for it.
Happy birthday, NHS!
Happy birthday, NHS!
Happy birthday, NHS!
Happy birthday, NHS!
Happy birthday to the NHS!
Get that vaccine!
I've had mine.
I look fantastic!
Just get a vaccination.
The NHS is an incredible institution that I think everybody in Britain is really proud of.
And on the lawns of the palace, Prince William hosted the NHS Big Tea Party, a reminder that as we pay tribute to the dedication of our health workers, their emergency is not over.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, or the Trumpet Daily Show, I should say, seeing as we go out live on video on our website, thetrumpet.com. But this is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. We're also, as well as on that website, we're on CRN Digital Talk Radio on CRN3. Very happy to be there. We've got our Facebook stream, I believe, is still able to go out, even though our YouTube stream is not. Well, if you're in the US, I hope you had a great 4th of July weekend. But here in the UK, as you saw from that introductory montage, we had a bit of a national holiday, a national celebration of sorts of our own. And I don't really know too many ordinary people that were actually observing that, but it wouldn't surprise me if in a few years, July 5th becomes a national holiday in the UK. It's the birthday of the NHS, the National Health Service. And you know, you saw the kind of things that people were saying about it in that clip. Britain's greatest achievement. Now, you can think of everything that Britain has accomplished, and you know, standing alone against Nazism and freeing the world from Napoleon. There's the British Empire traveling around the world and eradicating slavery. You've got things like Shakespeare, a push to get the Bible into the language that people can read. These are just all things right off the top of my head, but greater than all of that, apparently, greatest ever achievement is the NHS. Sir Keir Starmer, the main left-wing leader, he called the NHS our country's greatest institution when he was tweeting out that. And so I didn't want to talk about this for a bit. There was another big event with the NHS yesterday. It's a UK story, but this is not just a story for the UK. This is about how empires, superpowers, nations rise and fall. It's very relevant to the US as they look to plunge into exactly the same direction. It's very relevant for any nation that's looking to go down this road. I mean, Britain chose spending at home, chose the NHS over a role in the world, and we're still very proud of that decision, you know, 73 years on. And we no longer praise those that dare great things, that achieve mightily, that take huge risks and pull them off. Instead, we worship the NHS and we all have to stay at home and stay 2 meters apart and wear a mask and never do anything fun because there's a slight risk of a disease that might burden the sacred NHS. Now, this is about government decisions that help destroy a nation, that help destroy individual character. And that character is at the foundation of a nation's greatness. It's about the decisions that spread a spirit of surrender, demoralization. But one of the big pieces of news from this NHS celebration yesterday, I don't think we didn't, well, you didn't see it in the montage, but in some ways it's an even bigger piece of news. The NHS was awarded the George Cross, which this is huge. The George Cross is Britain's highest civilian award. Massive achievement. You have to really do something impressive generally to get the George Cross. And you know what is even rarer than an individual getting the George Cross is for an institution to be awarded the George Cross. It's only been given to a collective body twice before in history. Very famously, it was awarded to the island of Malta. They were under siege, I think it was for around 2 years, a long period of time during World War II. And it was horrific what they had to go through in that siege. The whole population was just on the brink of starvation as Germany was just trying to prevent any kind of food getting into the island. 1,300 civilians were killed, 2,300 airmen killed or wounded, 30,000 buildings destroyed or damaged, huge number of ships sunk. It was being bombed, being bombarded, being cut off, and it had to put up with this terrible ordeal. And that was the first time that a collective, that the George Cross was awarded to a collective organization or to a body of people as a whole. And certainly I think it very well merited a stirring example of widespread heroism there. And that's what we used to give this award to. The other time that the George Cross has been given to a body was to the Royal Ulster Constabulary, who were fighting against the IRA in Northern Ireland. They had 300 officers murdered and thousands more injured in Northern Ireland. James Denningpole wrote, the award was given in recognition for their going to work every day, knowing well they could be attacked, tortured, or killed. Every day during the Troubles, an RUC, or Royal Ulster Constabulary officer, would spend their entire service, and indeed their days of retirement, wondering whether today would be the day when they'd be kneecapped or have their limbs blown off or shot or otherwise tortured to death by the IRA. I'm not sure that even the most heavily exposed NHS workers had to face quite such an intense burden of fear. And I'm not against showing appreciation to doctors and nurses. I think we sent a thank you card to our midwife after our first daughter was born, if I remember correctly. But the NHS and the siege of Malta are just not at all comparable. I mean, you look at what the definition for the George Cross is. I should have brought that with me, but I think it's for conspicuous gallantry, extreme heroism, if I remember correctly, that kind of thing. And no matter, it's very hard to say that is what we've seen from the NHS. No matter how well you might think they've performed during the pandemic and during the last 73 years. But you saw in that video there, they had a big church service, a Thanksgiving service for the National Health Service, a party at Buckingham Palace where you couldn't have that many people over to your own house, I don't think. I think the limit is 30. I don't know how they got around the rules to be able to hold that. Maybe they did keep it to under 30 somehow or something like that. But they will celebrate that and have this massive day for that. The politician Nigel Lawson, he famously quipped, the NHS is the closest thing the English people have to a religion. And seeing all of those people gathered in church to have this NHS service, you certainly see that. I mean, we've seen that throughout this pandemic over the last year or year and more. During the first lockdown, it was 8 p.m. Thursday, clap for carers. You had to come out and applaud the NHS. Everyone would come out and stand on their doorstep and clap. And church services were cancelled, but clap for the NHS. Well, that was dead on. I think you see something similar happening in the U.S. in the aftermath of COVID. Definitely not to the same extreme. But you look especially in some of the liberal areas, there's this kind of a religious effect. I mean, you saw it even with Mr. Flurry's program on Dr. Fauci yesterday. If you disagree with Dr. Fauci, you are arguing with truth and science. He is the authority, and you cannot question that. It's heresy. You're arguing with truth. It's not about debate. It's not about, okay, let's hear what you have to say, and I'll tell you why I think you're wrong. You just can't argue with it, because if you do, you are arguing with the truth. I mean, you see it with the vaccine. It's not your body, your choice. You don't want the vaccine? Heresy. You talk about the vaccine. If you give reasons why you think people shouldn't have the vaccine, well, again, it's not a reasoned debate. It's your shutdown. You can't say that on social media, on a whole load of other places. Here in the UK, the NHS is just about the only British institution the mainstream media generally deems it acceptable to be proud of. And you saw some of those quotes, our greatest achievement. And you know, we have the football going on right now, the Euro 2020 competition. You may have noticed that with the beginning of one of our other shows this last week. I was actually tempted to open with some footage from England's 4-0 victory over Ukraine on the show this morning. But coming back to my point, every time there's a big football competition, you get all the lefties get upset because you've got all the England flags out and you've got displays of patriotism, and they can't stand that. That is unacceptable to them. You can't be proud of England, of Britain, of British history, but you can be proud of the NHS. That's about the only thing. You know, Matt Hancock, he had his resignation letter. You know, I'm sure you've all, Mr. Flurry talked about it on the show. Him being caught breaking his own rules, having an affair, and he had to go. But in his NHS letter, he wrote, "The NHS is the best gift a nation has ever given itself." So this is not just the best thing Britain's ever done. This is the best thing any nation anywhere has done, or at least given itself. This Telegraph piece says, really? Better than fighter pilots in 1940, or universal suffrage, or the abolition of slavery? Better than the US Constitution? If the US is such a wonderful thing, why do almost no other advanced nations use the same model? And by the way, the word gift is an odd one to describe our single most expensive taxpayer-funded entity. And so much of this worship of the NHS is just bizarre. This is something you're never meant to say, but it's not really that good. I shouldn't whisper, I'll sound like Joe Biden. But it's not. And again, it's treated like heresy to criticize it, but you look at the data. And I could almost understand some of the NHS worship that we have here in the UK if we had created this amazing, wonderful, not seen anywhere else in the world health service that did all of these things. Almost understand it, maybe. But that's not what we have. This Telegraph article goes on to say, this was a different one, actually. An IAE paper published in 2016 illustrated the NHS's shortcomings with startling clarity. It talks about just 4 common rates of cancer. And said, if treated in the Netherlands rather than by the NHS, 9,000 lives would be saved. In Germany, 12,000. In Belgium, 14,000 families would still have their loved ones with them. Thousands of extra people die because the NHS is worse than other healthcare systems all around the world. Even America, I mean, people in Britain love to kind of look at the American healthcare systems as being barbaric. But you look at the outcomes and the NHS fails compared to just even the quote unquote Wild West of just private healthcare systems. You know, we've seen all throughout COVID, you know, well, if it just saves one life, it's worth it. Yet scrapping the NHS and having a system that just about any other modern developed country has accepted would save tens of thousands of lives each year. You know, just in these 4 cancers, you'd be looking at well over 10,000 lives every single year if we scrapped the NHS and replaced it. But you can't say that. I was looking through this book by James Bartholomew, The Welfare State We're In. It's a bit of an older book, I guess, in terms of the stats are maybe 10, 20 years out of date now. Yes, published in 2004. So some of the figures are a bit out of date, but he gives some startling statistics about the NHS. He goes through and tries to crunch some numbers to compare how the NHS performs to what he calls an averagely good system. You know, just an average healthcare system for a rich developed nation like the UK. And he came to kind of, his minimum figure, I think, was about 15,000 extra people dying each year because of the NHS. His more reasonable figure was 48,000 people dying because the NHS is that much worse than just an averagely good healthcare system. 128,000 people died of COVID. He's talking about 48,000 every single year dying because of the NHS falling short, just compared with an average healthcare system. And of course, the 128,000, I said, of COVID, with COVID, of course, and you know, there's all of the massive uncertainties and incentives to overestimate, etc., with the, that COVID death toll. But still, you know, that's, you're looking at a COVID pandemic cumulatively every 2 or 3 years, just from the NHS falling short compared to other healthcare systems. And that doesn't, we don't do anything about it. There's no outrage. You can't criticize them. Instead, we'll give them the George Cross. We will hold a Thanksgiving service at St. Paul's Cathedral, where we can all come together and worship the NHS. You know, we don't have something world-beating, something, but something bureaucratic and stuffed with managers. Again, the stats are about 20 years old, but the NHS employs 4 times as many managers and support staff compared to private hospitals. And the number of managers in the NHS just keep going up and up and up and up. So between 1995 and 2001, the number of nurses increased by 7.8%, while the number of managers went up by 24%, and the number of senior managers went up by 48%. So you're just having this massive growth in fat cats running it. And you, I mean, that's been the story of the NHS, this absolutely massive growth. And he talks about how just throughout all of its history, this has been the pattern, this massive growth in managers, disproportionately way higher than the growth of actual medical personnel. This was something, but this is something, it was almost universally adopted at the time the NHS was created after the Second World War. You know, even before World War II was over, we got rid of Winston Churchill and brought in a new Labour Party. And this idea of social spending in the NHS was a big part of the reason why. You know, they promised housing, jobs, social reform, socialism, and won by a landslide. And I think, you know, Winston Churchill also talked about setting up a healthcare system. It was so desired by everybody that he promised that too. But Labour won because they were the ones kind of people viewed as more credible to fulfill this priority of a healthcare system and a welfare system. And so you had the NHS that just very quickly started exploding. Healthcare cost almost doubled from 1948 to 1951. You had a new social security system, a new national insurance system, things like this. And to protect jobs, the state ended up nationalizing all kinds of British industry. And there was a big socialist agenda behind this. The Labour government that brought this in sang the red flag on their first day in Parliament after the election. You know, this communist anthem, they were there in Parliament singing it. Britain had beaten National Socialism in World War II, and then now this socialist government came in. Anurin Bevin played a key role in founding the NHS, and Michael Foote, a fellow politician, he talked about how Bevin's thinking was rooted in Marxism. He said Marxism taught him that society must be changed swiftly, intrepidly, fundamentally, if the transformation was not to be overturned by counter-revolution. So the NHS was fundamentally a Marxist project from its start, brought in by a socialist government, by this man whose thinking was rooted in Marxism. It was a way to get this in through the door. It's a way, and you can see why it's a kind of, in some ways, a way to make Marxism appealing. And the idea, I get the idea that you could have a sick child and they can't, there's a cure and they can't get treated because you can't afford the treatment, is something that's pretty horrifying. If all of your trust is just in man to take care of you. But that's not what the situation was before the NHS. But you can see how then it kind of puts that humanitarian face on socialism. And I think it's fascinating. You had someone like Margaret Thatcher who came along later who did so much to combat the poison of socialism and roll back a lot of the way that socialism had infiltrated into the British government. She couldn't uproot the NHS. That was just too deeply embedded into the national psyche. It was a bridgehead that the socialists were able to take and hold after World War II, and it's now a national religion. It would be incredibly hard to dislodge it. You have all of this data showing that it's failing, but still, we give it awards and we worship it at St. Paul's Cathedral. It's just, you know, it embeds this idea that the government needs to take care of us. I think it's just, I mean, you see the massive change in Britain's psyche over the past several hundred years. And, you know, how much does that get back to the NHS, the welfare state, all of this? This whole move away from personal responsibility. You make your own decisions, and if you get those decisions wrong or if you make poor decisions, you suffer the consequences of that. To this idea that society as a whole will insulate you from the negative repercussions of your decisions. If you smoke and are overweight and don't take care of yourself, society is going to step in and pay for the resulting costs. If you raise children out of wedlock and can't afford to pay for them, and you have all of these separate homes and things like that, well, society will come in and step in and take care of that. So you've had that, and then you've got this now kind of totalitarian shift to that with, well, for the good of society, so society can continue to do these things, we have to force you now. We have to compel you to not go to work. The government will tell you who you can and who you cannot talk to. We will say you cannot step outside your house unless we approve of the reason why. We have to rob you of your freedoms because, well, we have the shared responsibility to protect the NHS. It's a very easy wedge in the door for Marxism. And at the same time as you had this wedge in the door, you saw this complete turn away from empire, from playing a positive role in the world. I mean, you could, in some ways, this was like the peak of Britain's positive role in the world, maybe. I haven't thought that idea through perhaps enough to stand solidly behind it, but defeating Nazism, that's got to be one of the British Empire's greatest ever achievements, up there along with eradicating slavery. And at the peak of that, Britain then turns the door and says, nah, you know, we're not interested in a mission for the wider world. We're not interested in greatness or glory. We want to turn towards this welfare system. And you know, you had the defense spending necessary to maintain Britain as a major power was very quickly cut to make room for these ballooning welfare costs. You know, they do this all the time. There's a relatively small figure that's brought in as saying this is how much it will cost. Once it's approved, it just balloons massively, and they have to find all. And then it's very hard to cut the social programs, so the military ends up getting cut. For many, January 1968 marks the kind of official end of the British Empire. Prime Minister Harold Wilson announced that Britain would withdraw all of its forces east of the Suez Canal. It was the only way he could see to cut defence spending that needed to happen to protect the welfare spending. And you had bases all across Middle East and Asia abandoned. At the time, US Secretary of State Dean Rusk, he said he could not believe that free aspirin and false teeth were more important than Britain's role in the world. And Britain disagreed, Harold Wilson disagreed. I think most people in the UK, if not at the time, certainly today, would say that to them, free aspirin and false teeth are more important than Britain's role in the world. And it's important to go over this history because that's exactly the decision that you see people trying to persuade the United States to make. Now, there's some much more dangerous elements to what's going on in the United States right now. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But that's exactly the direction that people are saying, well, we need a $6 trillion infrastructure plan, and dad and mom, their infrastructure now too, and healthcare spending is infrastructure, and we need to pay for free childcare for everybody. And we're going to bring the troops home from Afghanistan and withdraw from the world so that we can turn and focus on ourselves. But when Britain did this, the results around the world were disastrous. And the world paid the penalty for this decision, for Britain after World War II, just focusing inwards. Paul Johnson, in his book Modern Times, wrote that Britain's policy was confusion and irresolution. There was a failure of vision, a collapse of will, In 1945, Britain controlled one third of the world. I think that was my words, but he goes on to say no nation had ever carried such wide-ranging responsibilities. 25 years later, everything had gone. History had never before witnessed a transformation of such extent and rapidity. And so Britain just hurried to pull out and kind of hand power over to the most convenient people at hand. And usually those most convenient people were kind of a new group of elite politicians. And it was a disaster. Johnson writes that India illustrates the process whereby the full-time professional politician inherited the earth in the 20th century. Reforms created an alien system of representation. A class of men, mainly lawyers, organized themselves to manipulate it. In due course, the governing power was handed over to them. The dialogue was entirely between the old and the new elites. The ordinary people did not come into play, except as a gigantic walk-on crowd in the background. The process was repeated all over Asia and Africa. And so you had, you know, India and Pakistan, this rush to pull out and this incompetence behind it meant that you had ethnic tensions explode. You had somewhere around 1 million people killed through violence as they left. 5 million forced to flee their homes. You had India and Pakistan going on to fight a total of 4 wars with each other. They're in a nuclear standoff even today. Yet Britain kind of looks at that as a big achievement. Well, at the time, the government lied about the number of people that died. They said only 100,000 people have died, which was a lie, but, you know, only 100,000. You wouldn't say that in the days of COVID. Andrew Roberts, in his book, The History of the English-Speaking People Since 1900, he says this represents one of the most shameful moments in the history of the English-speaking peoples in the 20th century. But it played out again and again. And look who you had pop up in those countries where Britain withdrew, because we were just in a hurry to get out. You know, Robert Mugabe, Idi Amin, Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser. And if there'd have been even some kind of vision of responsible drawdown, things maybe have gone differently. But we just dropped the empire, let it shatter, so that we could get to the NHS and the welfare state. Well, I'm going for nearly half an hour. We'll take a quick break. When we get back, we will continue to talk about the NHS, but I also want to talk about America's withdrawal from Afghanistan, too. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. Education is something most people take for granted. We assume it is something one acquires after graduating from a college or university. Yet the 20th century knowledge explosion has done little to solve the problems of this world. Crime, broken families, suicide, disease, mass illiteracy, and poverty. Why, in a world filled with so much advanced material knowledge, are there so many unsolvable problems? Why, after 6,000 years, has mankind been unable to find the solution to its escalating evils or to the number one problem it now faces, that of human survival? Our free booklet, Education with Vision, will show you what is wrong with education today. It will show you what is true education with vision and how to achieve it. Request your free copy of Education with Vision at our website, thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
The last American troops cleared out of Bagram Air Base without celebrations or fanfare. The U.S. military, citing security concerns, is not saying when or how U.S. troops are leaving. Bases are shutting down without hardly a peep. As U.S. troops leave, some Afghan security units are collapsing. The Taliban's propaganda channels, in confirmed events, show Afghan police and soldiers giving up their bases and their weapons. The Taliban have even been handing out pocket money to pay for their transport home. Humiliation.
Well, that's the latest from Afghanistan. Britain, I think, officially completed its drawdown, bringing to a close 20 years of British military presence in Afghanistan. The US completed a major part of their withdrawal by Independence Day. They were speeding up the withdrawal as the Taliban really spread out throughout the country. So you've, and they've been, the Taliban, they've been encouraged by the news that America will be out of there by the 20th anniversary of 9/11. The former head of the British Army, he wrote in the Telegraph, district after district has fallen to the Taliban in recent days. The Afghan National Army has seemingly lost the will to fight. And many soldiers are abandoning their posts, no longer supported by substantial international air power. In response, the American withdrawal has been accelerated from September 11th to July 4th. So how's that for a memorial for American Independence Day, pulling out of Afghanistan? It talks about, well, he just talks about some of the mistakes that he thinks were made here. This particular general, he concludes by saying, the conflict in Afghanistan has truly been a war among the people and for the people. But ultimately, Taliban force of arms has prevailed, and those people of the country have been denied the chance to choose a better way of life. Tragically, a descent into civil war seems highly likely. So America and Britain and, well, all of NATO, we were defeated in Afghanistan by the Taliban, by this small crowd of, or small relatively compared to the might of the United States and these other powers, tribesmen. But, you know, all the way back, I went back, this is from the November 2001 Trumpet magazine, right after September 11th, right after America went into Afghanistan, we said this would happen. Trumpet managing editor Joel Hilliker had an article, The Head of the Snake. And in that he wrote, does America have the will to see it through? What happens when the war spreads from Afghanistan to other less isolated governments, when world opinion begins to turn on the United States? What happens if American soldiers begin to die, or if retaliatory terrorist attacks on American soil intensifies? Would the unanimity of public opinion fracture? Would fear intensify and determination falter? While the U.S. wants to eliminate terrorism and is becoming more aggressive in trying to do so, its efforts will fall short. How's that for tomorrow's news today? This is 20 years ago. It frankly does not have the necessary will to tackle the enormity of the problem. Thus, America is forced to confront the issue using clever half-measures. At this point, Iran is no longer considered a state sponsor of terrorism. Instead, in a telling twist of irony, it is being courted as an ally in fighting terrorism. The Trumpet, Mr. Hilliker writes, has often written, the pride of America's power has been broken. That is God's doing, a curse on a nation that rejected his commandments and abandoned his protection. With the country currently standing at attention, singing patriotic anthems and waving flags, padding its security, issuing proclamations and orders, deploying ships and planes and personnel, America may appear strong to some. These actions may be temporarily holding the next attack at bay, but on the whole, they're not acts of courage, but of fear, and they're not complete or savage enough to eliminate the threat. America doesn't have the will to defeat and conquer terrorism. And you know, he was writing that article, like I said, it comes from 20 years ago. Long before then, Herbert W. Armstrong said, we have won our last war. There's a chapter in our Holy Roman Empire. He was right, book called that, exactly that. We have won our last war. Talking about how America would not win another war again. And, well, that's what we saw. That informed our forecast of what would happen in Afghanistan. And it seems crazy. I mean, if you look at how everything got started in Afghanistan, to say America's not going to win that war, that in this battle between the world's greatest superpower and some hill tribesmen and religious fanatics, America will lose. That didn't seem like a sensible forecast, I don't think, 20 years ago. It was right, though. And you know, that statement from Mr. Armstrong, we have won our last war, that was based on Bible prophecy. You know, he wrote the United States and Britain in prophecy based on what's written in the Bible, based on revealed truth from the Bible. And that talks about all of these blessings that have been given to Britain and to America. And it said that those blessings have been reversed. The Bible talks about that. And so Mr. Armstrong made that forecast. Well, okay, the Bible says these blessings have been reversed. We've been given all of these military blessings and victories because of these blessings. Now they're being withdrawn. So, well, we've won our last war. It was a statement based on revealed truth. And that's why he could say that, and that's why it's been proven so completely right time and time again. America failed to win the Korean War, failed to win in Vietnam. Other conflicts that just looked like it should be easy. Failed to win in Afghanistan, failed in all these other places. The result in Iraq is just to hand that country over to Iran. But of course, US President Joe Biden was asked about America's withdrawal. And here's what he had to say when asked about this.
At the White House, President Biden also did not want to draw attention to Afghanistan, bristling when reporters pressed him today about the impact of the withdrawal.
Are you worried that the Afghan government might fall?
I think they have the capacity to be able to sustain the government.
I fought on Afghanistan.
I want to talk about happy things, man.
Afghanistan.
I'm not going to answer any more questions on Afghanistan. Look, it's 4th of July.
It's 4th of July. Just focus on this big holiday. No need to worry about what's happening thousands and thousands of miles away. And that's my main point here with Afghanistan. I mean, you know, at this point, it's not like there's a simple, easy thing that President Biden could have done instead. That, oh, if he'd have only done X or Y, there would have been... I mean, it's definitely not... I guess the closest to that would be to turn to God and seek his blessings for what's going on here. But you know, America's been there for 20 years. They haven't solved the problem. There's, given that America isn't willing to go to the lengths, or Britain either, that would be necessary to solve the problem, keeping the troops there, you know, maybe it wouldn't even accomplish that much. I could see there being an argument for bringing them home. My point is not just to say, oh, we need to necessarily be keeping the troops there. It's that this is part of a whole pattern and system of let's just withdraw from the world, just like Britain did after World War II. You know, focus on July 4th, focus on the celebrations. I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about my infrastructure spending plan. You know, that kind of approach. We're withdrawing from the world, we're cutting back, and we are going to focus on inwards, and we're going to try and spend all this money on ourselves instead. And for Britain, well, when Britain did this, there was a benign superpower ready to take up the slack. When Britain stepped up from its role in the world, the United States was there to take over that role to a certain extent. And so, yes, there were bad consequences of this decision, but it wasn't earth-destroying. Everything didn't immediately all fall apart all over the world because there was another power there. Who's there to pick up those? The US retreats and focuses on these plans? Well, there's China. But do you really want a world run by the Chinese Communist Party? It seems like a lot of the elites in Washington do, but that's not a pleasant world by any means. And fine, you could say, well, actually, let me just, before I get to that, if you look at what America's doing now, the vast amounts of money they're spending on COVID, you do see a similar pattern. This is coming back to Andrew Roberts. He says, when Attlee became prime minister in July 1945, between VE Day and VJ Day, the greatest long-term threat to his country was that she would squander the opportunities she'd won and thereby hamstrung future generations of Britons. Over a quarter of her national wealth had been lost during the previous 6 years of war. So the vast sums of Marshall Aid were being directed from America, desperately needed to be spent rebuilding her industrial and transport infrastructure and making her economy competitive again. Instead of doing that, Attlee effectively wasted it on trying to build the utopian society which socialists in these heady days called the New Jerusalem. And that's exactly what you see the United States doing now with coronavirus. There's been massive amounts of economic devastation. Unlike World War II, that's been self-inflicted devastation. But instead of trying to get back to work, trying to repair some of this devastation, there's this same utopianism of, well, let's build back better. We can't just go back, we can't allow things to go back to normal. We need to build this new Jerusalem. We need to build a new utopia. We need to direct our spending to make a society fundamentally different. And at best, that's just a waste of money. But it's a lot, lot more than that, really, the negative effects of that. But, I mean, what you have the U.S. set to waste all of, to pour all of this money into the, what was it, a $6 trillion infrastructure plan, or the government's first budget proposal on May 27th, or Mr. Biden's first budget proposal, called on the government to spend $6 trillion in the fiscal year 2020, the highest level of sustained federal spending since World War II. There is $1.7 trillion in that for discretionary expenditure. Just a massive amount of spending growth. And that's just there to continue. There was, in that budget, there was $16 billion for the American Families Plan, $8.4 billion for American Jobs Plan, which are things like sneak ways to try and get in the Green New Deal, universal daycare, by calling them infrastructure programs, basically. Of the Trumpet, we had an article. We wrote, his vision is to enlarge the government to the biggest it has been since World War II, not to defeat the evils of Nazism and Japanese imperialism, but to pay for electric cars, home health aides, and universal daycare. And this has been funded by a massive level of borrowing. So you could look at, what America's doing, withdrawing from Afghanistan, some of these other things, and say, well, fine, why should the U.S. be concerned with peace and stability around the world? That's not our problem. Let's focus inwards and dealing with our own problem. But that change and that focus inwards for Britain was absolutely devastating. And you see, just looking at those economic figures, how that can be devastating just economically. But more than that, what does this big shift towards socialism just do for a nation as a whole? And that's what's really going on here, withdrawing from the world so we can spend money on socialism at home. By 1950, Britain was investing 9% of its economy into industry and infrastructure. Germany was 19%. Because they were directing the money in the right kind of places, while Britain was wasting it on all of these utopian projects. You had a government that focused on, rather than making industries efficient, creating jobs, which kind of sounds great on paper, and this led to nationalization, government jobs, exactly the same kind of thing you see people in the left pushing, and it collapsed British industry. It killed British manufacturing industry. 1950, the UK produced more than half of all the world's vehicle exports. Now, there are no major car manufacturers still owned by British companies. And only after you had nationalization erased by all these foreign car companies coming in and buying the wrecked car manufacturers could you actually have cars being made decently in the country. But it led to just this massive change in mindset. And that, I think, is what's most dangerous here. One of the most dangerous things. Where, I can understand why people would want a national health service, where this idea that you have a loved one that is sick and the recovery is, the key to recovery is very expensive, and the idea that they could die from lack of money. Then the post-war government after World War II did have major inequalities. People, lived in poverty in a way that we just don't experience today. And they wanted the government to help them with more wealth, more security. But that inward focus was just devastating. You had this Marxist type of thinking infiltrate the country, and it destroyed the British Empire. And you look at the change in Britain's focus. So much of the British Empire in the 18th and 19th century, there was a big push to make the world a better place, an outwards focus here. British diplomacy and the Royal Navy helped stamp out slavery. I gave a program on that last year. This is the British Empire that stopped Napoleon from conquering Europe. Jan Morris, in his book on the Victorian Empire, the Victorian period, Heaven's Command, he wrote, for many Victorian Englishmen, the instinct of empire was first to be rationalized as a call to Christian duty. In 1850, Prime Minister Lord John Russell, He talked about, well, he was talking about Britain's efforts to stamp out the slave trade. He said, if we are to give up this high and holy work and proclaim ourselves no longer fitted to lead in the championship against the curse and the crime of slavery, then we no longer have a right to expect a continuance of those blessings which, by God's favor, we have so long enjoyed. To them, there was a noble purpose in what they were doing, an outwards-looking purpose in what they were doing. And that was the view of many, definitely not everyone, but many, that the empire, expand the empire as a force for good, and they would be blessed by God. There was a strong, much stronger religious belief then. Was that always done perfectly? Absolutely not. Were there some very selfish individuals involved with that? Definitely. And a lot of self-righteousness? Yes. But this outward focus created an empire that benefited the world and that benefited Britain too. Britain sent its wealth, its men, its ideas and institutions abroad. Niall Ferguson, in his book Empire, he wrote, "The fact remains that no organization in history has done more to promote the free movement of goods, capital and labor than the British Empire in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And no organization has done more to impose Western norms of law, order and governance around the world." And when Britain had this grand outward vision, it rose. And then when we turned inwards, the empire fell. And now we've got this situation where we laud the NHS as our greatest achievement and give it the highest civilian honor. And look at the country today. Look at the crime. Look at the, you know, it's not just a case of not having a role in the world. This kind of collapse of vision and purpose has led to a hopeless generation. It's led to us crowding indoors, scared of our own shadows because of a virus that 99.97, I mean, so many people survive, it's hard to keep track of all the numbers. It's a virus that I am about as likely to die because an aeroplane crashed on my house as I am because of COVID. Yet we will cower in fear. And yes, I did crunch the numbers on that. Will cower in fear because of this virus. That's the difference between a nation that's focused inwards and focused outwards. And that's perhaps the most pernicious effect of this type of Marxist programs. Now, as I said, when you see the same programs being rolled out in the United States, they're not going to have there's not going to be the luxury of waiting 73 years to celebrate the birthday of these various different programs to look back and realize that they've been a mistake. This is a very different world to the world in 1945. There is no other superpower waiting in the wings, at least none that's going to uphold a similar standard around the world and behave in a similar way and uphold similar norms of the rule of law and free trade, etc. Absolutely not. But then the people bringing about this revolution are very different, much more ambitious. You know, they're not going to be content with just having something that slowly injects socialism into the American system or just securing a beachhead. There's a much more rapid push here. Because behind both of these is a desire to eliminate these nations that have been a force for good in the world, but most of all are nations that point people to God, whether they manage to live up to their promise of being a force for good or not. You know, like Mr. Armstrong talks about in the United States and Britain in prophecy, these two nations were prophesied to rise to greatness in your Bible. You can read, and he goes through, he makes it so simple and clear, plain and easy to prove. And you go through that book with your Bible and it's unarguable. There's no, it's case closed. He proves everything. Don't believe what I'm saying. Get the book and prove it for yourself. But in there he shows you, you go through the Bible and there's all of these promises, all throughout the book of Genesis even, where God's saying to Abraham and others, you know, I will make great nations out of you, great nations. Plural, and you know, just absolutely massive countries, and you know, talks about descendants being thousands or 10,000, 1,000 times 1,000, as innumerable as the stars of heaven. And you look around and see, well, you know, the state of Israel in the Middle East, that does not fulfill these prophecies, as massive as they are, as huge as they promise, the promises are in that book and elsewhere. And so the only logical conclusion is, well, there are other descendants from Israel. And sure enough, you know, the Jews, they're just one tribe of the descendants from Israel. Britain and America are also descended from Israel. The blessings and the rise to greatness that Britain and America experienced, the rise to greatness that many in America are celebrating over the weekend, that's direct fulfillment of Bible prophecy. That history is a massive signpost that points you to God, that points you to the Bible, that points you to the fact that God rules over man, that he's in charge, and that world history is unfolding according to his plan and his purpose. And that purpose is going to stand no matter what individuals do. And individuals can certainly choose, I'm not saying personal choice doesn't matter, but God rules. And so Satan hates that. He hates that massive signpost. He attacks that massive signpost. And God allows those attacks when these nations sin and disobey him and rebel against him. And so he brought down and he attacks Britain and worked to bring down the British Empire. But as we get closer and closer to Christ's return, the Bible talks about Satan being cast down, Satan being in a bigger wrath, more wrath, or worse wrath, more anger, more hatred. The times today are so much more urgent. It's not going to take 73 years or more to bring down the United States. They're pushing for a sudden overthrow. I mean, you see that in all of the election shenanigans. So it's not like America is going down exactly the same path as Britain. It's a dramatically accelerated process, and even that's an underestimation. You know, it's different this time because of that different time period. But you can see the outlines of the same tactics. Bringing in this Marxism, getting this inward focus. I mean, it was the same with the Worldwide Church of God. A focus of, let's not get out and give to the world, but let's focus inwards and see what we can do for us. And it destroyed that church. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, he had an article several years ago on, and well, we reprinted it more recently as well, actually, on Winston Churchill's vision of empire. And he wrote, there was a selfless, altruistic, noble dimension to his devotion to the British Empire. He wrote, humanity has certainly produced some very evil empires. That ugly history has contributed to the evil view that many today have expressed that empire in general, especially among institutions and scholars in the West, is evil. However, the existence of these barbarizing empires doesn't change the good that a civilizing empire can do. Truly, the right kind of imperialism can accomplish great things. And he quotes James Anthony Froude in his book Oceania. A man who is more than himself, who is part of an institution, who has devoted himself to a cause, or as a citizen of an imperial power, expands to the scope and fullness of that larger organism. And the grander the organization, the larger and more important the unit that knows he belongs to it. His thoughts are wider, his interests less selfish, his ambitions ampler and noble. A great nation makes great men. A small nation makes little men. This retreat from greatness in Britain and America. I mean, that's what we're seeing with the West denigrating July 4th. Nothing to be proud of, nothing to aspire to there. It has a massive effect on the individuals, and that has a knock-on effect to the country. We need an outward-looking vision. We need something focused on giving, bringing things to other people. This is why the church failed when it stopped having that outward-looking vision. We need to be focused on giving to other people individually and collectively. Mr. Armstrong said in a radio broadcast, "My friends, I've noticed that those who have their hearts in the work of God remain Christians, and they grow spiritually, and they manage to overcome. And they who neglect it and just have their minds on themselves," well, he says, "I've never known anyone that could do that, and succeed." We need an outwards-focused vision, individually and collectively. Well, that's about all we've got time for. You can email us if you like at td@thetrumpet.com. We'd love to hear from you. And Mr. Stephen Flurry should be back, same place, same time tomorrow.